Lucy Meadwell. I'm the National and Sector Editor of EG, and it's great to see you all here at our second Thames Valley Question Time, particularly as it's such a lovely day, and I know I'm sure a lot of you would much rather be outside in the sunshine, although we do have the lovely terrace, so do make use of that afterwards. When we were here last year, it was the day of the EU referendum, and it was also a day where we'd had horrendous thunderstorms and torrential downpours, and Reading was gridlocked because there was localised flooding. So what a difference a year makes, and obviously a lot has changed in that time. I asked the audience at that time whether the next day we thought we'd still be staying in the EU or leaving, and the unanimous answer was they thought we would be staying. So a lot has definitely changed. And a lot of those points are going to be reflected in the questions that people have been submitted. I'm going to introduce our panel in a moment. Before I do, I just want to run very quickly through the order of proceedings. A lot of you have been pre-submitting questions. We had over 50 questions, which was absolutely wonderful. Obviously, we can't go through that many. We've only got an hour. So what I've done is I've gone through and I've distilled and picked out what I think are the key topics, the subjects that people are asking questions about the most. There is also the opportunity for you to ask questions as we go along. I will be pausing for people to put their hands up if they want to ask a question that way. Or if you are feeling quite techy, you can use something called Slido. If you've got a smartphone, you just go onto the Slido website. It's the web address is there. It's not an app, it's just a website, and you put in the hashtag EGQTTV and you submit your question. You can do that anonymously if you like. The questions will appear on the screens, either side, and on the monitor here for us. And you can vote on the questions. If there's a question on there that you like, you can say you like it. And the questions that get the most likes will rise to the top of the table, and I'll pick the ones that are the most popular. We've got a wide range of topics to get through. Obviously, we've already touched on Brexit. We've got questions about devolution. We've got a lot of questions about the office market. So there's a lot to get through. I'm going to try and get through as much as possible. But I do encourage you to ask your questions, because we want to make sure that you're getting the answers that you want from our panelists. So I'm going to ask my panelists to introduce themselves now before we kick off with the questions. James, you want
evening
to start?
Evening all, I'm James Silver from Landed. We're the developers of the building you sit in this evening. Over the course of about the last 5 years, we've developed 1 million square feet from Hammersmith out to Reading. We're big believers in the Thames Valley, and truth be told, been working here since the mid-90s.
Hello, my name is Peter Newton. I'm a director and architect at Barton Willmore. I also do a little bit of teaching at Oxford Brookes University in the architecture department, and I do some work with the Reading design review panel, so very interested in looking at Reading from a design point of view.
Good evening, everybody. My name is John Meal, Chief Operation Officer of ABP Royal Albert Dock. ABP is a large-scale Chinese developer, and we are developing a land opposite City Airport London, 5 million square foot, the London Mixed Business District.
Hello, everybody. My name's Guy Parks from Rare Property. I've been operating in the Southeast and Thames Valley markets for about 26 years and spend my time showing occupiers fabulous buildings and finding good investments for landlords as well.
Good evening, I'm Tim Smith. I run the local enterprise partnership for this area. By this area, I mean Berkshire, at the heart of the Thames Valley. There are 38 LIPs in England. We're all different. Mine is an SME. But in difference to my colleagues here, we're funded entirely by central government. My job is to compete with the other LIPs to get as much public sector investment into Berkshire as I possibly can. And at the moment, we're running a £182 million investment programme over 6 years, having secured that money through competitions.
Now, you might be wondering why John, who is developing in East London, is at a Thames Valley Question Time. John is our outsider, somebody from outside who is looking in and also thinking about perhaps whether occupiers might want to move east. So we're going to be bringing John in on some of the office questions, but also he's going to have a viewpoint on investment generally and, you know, what the opportunities are and things that actually affect investment decisions. So I just wanted to explain that, because obviously all our other panelists are quite obvious why they're here. It's not immediately obvious why John is here, but I'm hoping that having an outsider will generate some interesting thoughts. Okay, well, let's kick off. We're going to start off looking at sort of like some of the macro topics before we kind of drill down into some of the sort of more micro issues. So we're going to start off with Brexit, which is obviously a big topic to kick off. Quite a lot of people were asking about this, and I want to sort of start the panel with talking about what the impact of Brexit will be on the Thames Valley. Tim, do you want to start?
To me, the worry about Brexit is very straightforward, and it's a message we take to central government regularly, and that's our role, really. We're not the voice of business, we're the voice of the sub-region, and it lies in the foreign-owned companies in Berkshire. So in Berkshire alone, there are 945 foreign-owned companies. 40% of those companies are owned in North America, 30% are owned in Europe. That's the highest concentration in the whole of the UK. Not the highest number, but the highest concentration. And I think that's replicated in the areas, the LEP areas, around certainly around Berkshire, Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire, and to the south. My concern, and thus the impact of Brexit that I worry about, are the decisions made by the owners of those companies in other parts of the world that will hit in the midterm. I can't predict what those decisions are, and I hope we can speak later about some of the things that we can do to mitigate any negative decisions. But certainly if there's any one thing I worry about and any one message I take to government, it is this area is unique. It is unique because of that international flavour that makes our economy what it is, but it has a unique threat in that the decisions about future location, occupancy, are made elsewhere.
Does anybody else want to come in on that?
Yeah, I'd just say that he's right, it is a very diverse occupier base and influenced greatly by the States, but I'm seeing some massive optimism at the moment, particularly by the occupiers from the States. And we're seeing, whilst take-up is actually down a fraction, but only sort of 2%, quarter by quarter, we're actually seeing more transactions. And the majority of these transactions are from the Americas and companies coming in. What we are seeing, though, is that there's very few big requirements out there. And those companies are looking very carefully at their competitiveness in the light of Brexit. Mm-hmm. And they're very much being cautious, looking at shrinking their balance sheet, consolidating, and therefore they're in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment. But they are looking at the feasibility, and a lot of those people, I think, for the region, is good because they'll be coming out of London to the region because it's so much more cost-effective than being in central London. So in some places, 80% more cost-effective.
We're going to come on and talk a bit more detail about kind of costs and occupier demand. John, I wanted to bring you in on the Brexit question.
Being outsider of Thames Valley, probably I'm being outsider, look at this thing from all of UK as an international investor and how we see UK as a result of Brexit. First, I'll give you some information. China trade with Europe £300 billion worth every year. But one key point is China is not in Europe. So in order for the business to work, doesn't necessarily mean that you are part of European. Yeah. So it's the first key point. It is about a global market, it's about market and how Chinese investor, especially look at Brexit, is actually how the Brexit will make UK more international in terms of business. How does it make itself more competitive in terms of competing on the whole Western market for more investment from Asia? And this is how I see it. And I have spoken to many business in China, and Brexit is not even registered in their risk scale at this moment in time. And actual facts that demonstrate over the last 6 months, Chinese investment into real estate already exceeding the whole last 12 months. So it gives you some kind of indication of the confidence that investment from China as well as Asia, how strong it is, has been remained in UK real estate. And also we can actually see the government between UK and China are working even more closely together. Both leader of our both country is already say is in a golden era at this moment between the UK and China trade. And we can actually see every year the trade been increasing rapidly.
Tim, you wanted to
just
add?
To add really, I mean, another reason I'm delighted to be here is because I can hear firsthand from business colleagues as well as the audience. And so it's good to hear what Guy and John have said about that element of confidence. And as John has said, you know, it's not registering on many people's Richter scales. The other part answer to the question, I think, is we hosted a visit just within the last couple of weeks from the Canadian Trade Minister, the Trade Minister for Ontario, and they'd brought a delegation over, not by accident, but because when the decision was made and as they saw the negotiations approaching, they certainly wanted to reach out to the UK, and it happened to be the Thames Valley they wanted to reach out to, Thames Valley and London, predictably, because they're talking about unilateral trade between those two countries. And just one other dimension to that, what some of the economists are coining a phrase now, the Anglosphere, about the opportunities that exist in those English-speaking countries in particular, and how you might forge stronger trade relationships than we perhaps have had thus far in this rather amorphous thing called an Anglosphere. So that would be my additional comment.
Okay. I want to sort of bring it to more like local politics now and economics, and talk a bit about devolution. Our devolution came up a lot in the questions. And obviously, the Thames Valley hasn't got a combined authority or any sort of devolution deal. So one of the questions that came in is, would the formation of a Thames Valley authority with similar powers to the GLA be a help or a hindrance to the development industry? And James, I don't know whether, would you have a view on that? I mean, as a developer, would it make any difference if there was, you know, devolved powers, there was one sort of authority that had a sort of a broader scope?
I think that's the debate of the balance between the kind of we're stronger together argument and equally that creating more bureaucracy that slows things down. Actually, Reading is behaving like a city, feels like a city that is really working hard to bring itself forward. Would it be slowed down in that process if suddenly we were grouped in with a number of different towns across the region?
But what about Reading as opposed to the Thames Valley as a whole? I mean, I know when I go around the country and talk to people, the importance of a leadership is becoming more and more obvious, particularly from a developer's and investor's point of view. They will look at kind of the leadership of any town or city and when making decisions about whether to invest. So you've said that Reading, you know, Reading is good. What about if there was a leader for the entire Thames Valley? Does it matter that there are different authorities looking after different parts of the Thames Valley region?
Personally, I feel the system is working pretty well as it is, actually.
Okay.
We've had good relationships with the towns we've invested within. So Slough's been behind us for our big scheme next to the station there. Reading have worked tirelessly with us to bring this project forward. You look at how actively they're encouraging Station Hill's redevelopment next door. It does feel like the system is relatively working, but perhaps there is some power in those guys having a greater club above them.
Tim, what about having, obviously we've got new mayors now, and I mean, everybody's seen sort of, you know, what the various London mayors have done to kind of promote London. Now obviously Manchester's got a mayor, Birmingham's got a mayor, and they're sort of seen very much as figurehead roles. Do you think something like that would be good for Reading, or do you think it does a pretty good job of kind of Reading and the Thames Valley does a pretty good job of marketing itself anyway?
Gosh, I think the Thames Valley does a pretty good job economically. I mean, my patch has an economy worth £35 billion of GVA each year. That's a phenomenal economy. We have productivity levels that are higher than the rest of the UK outside of London. Some of the productivity levels higher than the US. So we do a good job with what we've got, and I don't think anybody would say that it isn't a fragmented system and that isn't sometimes hugely frustrating. My day job operates with 6 unitary authorities. I guess the way I would answer the question is, what difference would it make? And as has been said, you know, would the investment and the time and effort and money and taxpayers' money justify whatever increase in output we would achieve? I can tell you more specifically and locally, that in terms of the Berkshire political leaders, there is no appetite, none whatsoever. And their response is very clear. They don't see a benefit to the resident, to the council taxpayer, in a form of devolution or local government reorganisation. I think it's interesting when we talk about devolution, what do we mean? Are we talking about an elected mayor like Greater Manchester? And I suppose when I say we're talking about central government officials. If you ask them the question, devolution means 3 things. It means devolution as we understand it, It means local government reorganisation, so not having six small unitaries in this part of the world or in Buckinghamshire, districts and counties the same in Oxfordshire. And it means that directly elected mayor. Let's have a look at Oxfordshire. Mm-hmm. A very public spat has been going on for some months, if not years now, in Oxfordshire, not dissimilar in Buckinghamshire. So where do we want our political efforts and energies directed? So I talk from a perspective of having to make do with the environment that I operate in, the political environment. Of course, I think there would be benefits if it were more cohesive, but I think we have to look at the evidence and the economic output. And we would, you know, the evidence suggests we do well with what we have.
Theresa May said at the beginning of the year when she was launching the industrial strategy that priority is going to be given when it comes to government funding, priority will be given to those areas with devolution deals. I mean, obviously, Thames Valley is in the southeast in a different situation to say, you know, the cities in the Midlands and in the north and elsewhere. So it might be a different kind of, you know, a different kettle of fish. But does that cause any concern?
Yes. And again, I'll hopefully give you some an explicit and specific example. I said in my introductory comments that we compete for the central government funds. We do that through a growth deal. And we say to government, we want to deliver these or see these economic initiatives delivered. Will you give us the money to do them? Because what they will generate is this amount of houses or this amount of jobs or whatever. And we've done three growth deals with government now. The third one was the summer last year. The indicative deal that was offered to us, I don't know what adjective to use. It was disappointing. It was insulting, actually. And when we were debriefed by the officials at DCLG and Bayes, they said, your submission is first class, it's green all the way, until you get to that criterion, which is devolution and not having a devolution deal. Now, coming back to this point about being more cohesive, again, not only the Berkshire authorities, but business, the CBI, local government association actually came together, and we achieved a growth deal 3.5 times that original indicative deal. So it is of concern. Mm. And certainly my board, which is business-led, said to the political leaders at that point, you know, we risk not being at the table. The table increasingly is a city-region table. If we don't make more steps towards devolution. But I think your comments about what Theresa May has and hasn't said, the world changes more quickly than any of us can anticipate. And I think my view would be that is not current, that thinking anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, do you know what? My feeling is that we are actually, rather than devolving, we want to build greater ties with London and create that link, that Silicon Valley link with central London. And I think there's a major amount of investment that's been put into the Thames Valley today with, you know, the Elizabeth Line, the smart running of the M4, the Western Rail link to Heathrow, you know, everything. You know, so it's actually gained quite a lot. Mm. I don't feel that we're missing out at the moment.
Okay. John?
Probably I'm not qualified to talk about local politics, mm-hmm. but I want to bring from the business prospect on looking on devolution. And when I say devolution, it's probably about getting things done much quicker, having a more straightforward decision timetable, and also able to maybe control the local funding rather than going back to the central government. One of the key things I want to mention about, for example, in Royal Dock, where we are, we're lucky enough to be in the only enterprise zone in the southeast, where we can actually see all the rates, money and all that is going to be spend locally rather than going back to the central governments, and we can actually see that it's benefit greatly to the whole area of that area of how business can come in and also decision making. I mean, as a developer, planning and a given power that the in that sense is the planning can be done quicker rather than go through stage 1, 2, 3 all the way to Secretary of State. So there are benefits in that sense in terms of business-wise.
In terms of it streamlines the process. Okay, I want to sort of move on, but before I do that, any questions from the audience at this stage? I'm going to pick up on a couple of those, the points when we move on to the office and actually some questions specifically for John in a moment. Any questions from the floor? Okay. We've talked a bit about, we talked about Brexit, the bigger issues that are shaping the Thames Valley market, and we talked about devolution, which is a more smaller issue that could potentially shape the market. So I want to talk and move on to something a bit more specific to Reading, and that's the 2050 vision. And I wanted to ask, perhaps not all the panel, but a selection of you to sort of maybe outline what you think Reading should look like in 2050, what Reading should be in 2050. And then we'll use that as a launching point to talk more about kind of the office market as it is now and where it's moving to and whether it's moving towards that.
Well, I'd like to jump in there because we've been very much involved in the Reading 2050 process. And I think the interesting thing to me is not really what I or others of us in the profession think Reading should look like, but actually the level of engagement that we're getting from either from the public or from other institutions driven through the university or engaged with the local council. And the sort of the visionary and decision-making processes are actually very separated in a lot of places. And how do you draw people into that visioning process? How do you get their views of it? And I was reflecting on an event that was held about a year ago about sort of Thames Valley being cool. And I think you try and be cool, you can't. And I think the vision for 2050 is a way of, in some ways, I suppose, achieving that, but without trying to achieve that goal. It's drawing from people what they want this place to be. And there's a lot of people who are very connected here. And I think that's been one of the real insights to me is how much local residents and people that have been engaged in the process have felt about that. So the process has been really, really insightful, really wonderful.
Does anybody else want to come in on that and what you think Reading, what will be Reading in 2050?
What should it look like? I mean, it's about creating villages, communities, more mixed use, and this is happening in the town centre and also on the business parks as well. You're getting houses at Green Park where you've got sort of live-work environments going on. More of that, more amenity. I think the transport, there's a mass transport system going in Reading at the moment, which is going to help going in and out of town. But I think there's more than that. There's been talk about this, the third crossing of the river in Reading for eons. And there's just such a natural way down the 329M, bottom Thames Valley Park, over the bridge. But for some reason, that just can't happen quick enough. So I think things like that need to be looked at, but that's very short term, how it looks. I remember going to the session at the university that I think you held, and we had to draw on a map where, what we thought it would look like. And it was very much sort of bringing communities, little pockets of villages together with it throughout the town.
Pretty focused on place.
Yeah. Definitely.
Okay, now I want to pick up on one of the questions here because I wanted to turn to John now. And first of all, you obviously developing in East London, and we've got the Elizabeth, Guy, you've mentioned the Elizabeth Line Crossrail and kind of like the benefits of that. But John, presumably you see that as an advantage for East London as well, and you think occupiers might be tempted to go east. So let's start off with the sort of why you think they might do that, and then we'll talk about, pick up on the question about whether you would invest in the Thames Valley and west of London.
Sure. Just on the way driving up from East London all the way here, I was thinking, actually, what's the link between the two places? And what is the things? And rightly say it's the Crossrail. It took me almost 2.5 hours driving from all the way from East London to here, giving my fate to M25 and M4. Yeah. And what makes, there's a similarity between our development in East London and Reading is the Crossrail. We are two ends of the spectrum. And I think that is the main synergy. I mean, before I say driving 2.5 hour minimum from that side to here, by public transport, probably you're lucky, probably 1.5 hour, probably not in this kind of weather. Now with the Crossrail coming, pretty much is between the two extreme east and west, is about 1 hour journey time. And London, central London, where it all happens, is right back in the middle. So there's a similarity and synergy between the two places. And of course, business is about opportunity. and such opportunity occur in Thames Valley, we look at why I'm here today is Thames Valley is the digital heart for UK. And we know technology is the future to come, and that should be also seeing that technology is the future for UK as well. And there's also a lot of appetite in Asia and China to do and work more closer with UK in terms of high-tech cooperation in there. So I can actually see a lot of synergy. Foreign investment, foreign company want to come to UK market or want to merge or work partnership with UK market. They can have choice stay in London, or they could have a choice from Thames Valley. So likewise in Thames Valley, their R&D center is in Thames Valley, but they could also have a choice to have a point in central London, which is, I think everybody know Huawei is already in Thames Valley. They are one of the top high-tech company today, and they employ hundreds of people, local people in Thames Valley. But they also see the need for them to have a location in London, central London. We can't ignore the point, business start from London. And this is, we can have a research institute places in different location, and likewise, Huawei decide to have two offices in London, one in central London, the bank, and one now they have near the O2, which is more Eastern Wood. And we can actually see more and more high-tech company, especially from East, from Asia, will have similar kind of approach. And we can actually see also one similarity, I spoke to James about the rent as well. Now, the rent is almost equal between Reading and East London. And we can actually see in terms of cost of occupation is about the same. But therefore, there's a lot of synergy between the two places. And therefore, it would be a win-win situation. That's how I see the things. And how I see, and I'm here today, is let you know what opportunity we got for you in East London.
So coming to the question that's on the screen, and it's actually a question that was asked and pre-submitted. Obviously, you've argued the case for sort of East London and the synergy with Thames Valley. Would you invest in the Thames Valley?
We will invest anywhere there's opportunity. We are a large-scale commercial developer. We don't traditionally build just sell residential. We build major business district. In Beijing, which is our smallest project in China, is 20 million square feet. Our current project near Shanghai is almost 200 million square feet. So this is kind of scale.
We'll have some of that.
Yep. But one thing I've spoken to some of you in here is doing this major regeneration scheme. I call it regeneration because we don't want to demolish the CBD and rebuild it again. It's a major regeneration scheme, require a critical mass, require a commitment from the developer. But because of that, it requires working closely with the local government, with the government, so that we have a large enough piece of land which is all connected, and therefore we can do our job, not just building bricks and mortar, but also bring in business, bring in the people as network, and make that location work. Because everybody can put a building up, but not everybody can make a business district that buy.
So it's got to be, you'd invest if there was an opportunity of a certain scale.
That's right.
Okay, I want to, any questions from the floor at this stage? Before I move on, we're going to talk a bit more in a bit more detail about the Reading and Thames Valley office market, and we've talked a bit about the Crossrail impact. But one of the questions that came up from a pre-submitted questions is Reading developing enough Grade A offices to attract businesses following the completion of Crossrail? Guy, I don't know whether you wanted to pick up on that as an agent.
The answer is no, because actually, I don't think we've really quantified the true effects of Crossrail and the number of companies who are going to be coming out of central London. There's about, in the town centre, currently there's about 1.1 million square feet. Sounds a lot, but actually you only need another few sort of SSE, Scottish and Southern Electrics, coming in, taking 180, 200,000 square feet out of the stock. I think there are more there's four requirements that have been circulated in the last few days, 100,000 square feet, people either coming out of London or consolidating within the region. And they want to, they're really concentrating on Reading Town Centre because of the, it's really all about the talent, the skill base. Within a 20 mile radius or a 30 mile radius or about a 45 minute to an hour travel time, that covers down to the south coast and up beyond Oxford, out to sort of Swindon and into the West End. And this is why it's such a great spot. And with the Crossrail links as well, east to west, that's going to massively transform the number of people who are going to be looking. So I think, no.
But does it make it easier for people to like live in Reading and commute in and work in London?
Why would they want to do that?
I don't know.
Yeah, look, sure, I mean, they can go into the community, but looking at the demographic who...
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, no, look at the demographic who are out there. You know, we talk to the occupiers and we act for a number looking at property. I turned up to a viewing yesterday, guy was in his flip-flop, shorts, hoodie, you know, and it's sort of, that's the mentality. It's about lifestyle, and they don't want to go into central London. They want to be based out here, close to the action and close to the housing stock, and there's enough amenity going on. It's not perfect, but it's improving, and it's becoming more London-esque, if you like.
The interesting bit on that, I think, is I was talking to a couple of young guys from one of the big accountancy firms recently, and they failed to get graduate placements in London, so they had the choice of Manchester, Bristol, wherever else they might like to go and work, and the big reason they chose Reading was all about its links to London. Because if you are a 25-year-old, suddenly you can afford to live here, you can be in this area 3 days a week, but you still have that link ultimately back to London and the mothership, perhaps of these big accountancy firms. So in terms of a lifestyle choice for the future talent pool, it's a really nice blend there. You can afford your own house with a great lifestyle locally, but you do still have that connection to the senior partners in the London branch.
Okay, I want to move on to one of the questions on the screen. Actually, it cropped up in the pre-submitted questions as well. Does the panel see a future in out-of-town business parks given the priorities of the next generation of millennials coming through? Obviously, we talked a lot about Reading and, you know, occupiers being attracted to Reading Town Centre, but there are a lot of business parks around the Thames Valley. So what's their future?
Historically, our business was a business called Aquila, and that specialised in building out office parks throughout the UK and into Europe. So we've had a lot of kind of influence in that sector. Most recently, we've been in more urban locations. But if you look at the stats for the Thames Valley, for the last 5 or 6 years, certainly, it's been pretty much 50-50 in town and out of town. And whilst we all talk about the really cool, funky young millennial who wants this connection to London, there are plenty of us who get a little bit older and want to nest and want to be home for bath time and a slightly different lifestyle than perhaps that frenetic lifestyle gives you. So I still think it's a 50-50 market. The business park has to evolve. It has to have more amenity, facilities, and Green Park is a great example of if you do it well, people will fill your park up pretty damn quickly. So yes, I think there is a real opportunity for both in town and out town to thrive.
Sorry,
we're involved in a development of new business park, the Science Park, with Reading University. And I think from a design point of view, there's a whole range of business and organizations that need very specialist premises. The proton treatment facility, there's a really good example of that. And I think it'd be very difficult to house some of those science and technology-based companies in town centre locations. Although they're in the same competition for the talent pool and the millennials who want, you know, authentic street-based urbanism and those environments to work in, the priorities are not, you know, they have to balance themselves out. And I think that the business park offer gives much more flexibility in the kind of facility you can design and build, particularly for those specialist uses, I think. And I think that they can also cluster more effectively. So I think that's what happens at places like the Science Park and others. Harwell, perhaps, where there's complementary organizations that are clustering around, and then there's an organization that offers centralized facilities, maybe incubator units, entrepreneurial support and advice to sort of spring new businesses out of those, sometimes linked with academic organizations and research projects. So I think there's definitely a role for that, and I think the diversity gives a bit of resilience, and I think That's a really important part in any market because we can't always tell the future, and some diversity and some resilience is always a good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, one size doesn't fit all, basically. Mm. So you get some of the pharmaceutical companies who will definitely want to be in a business park setting, much more secure, and put a fence around it, and the media type tech cos, robotic companies may want to be in an urban environment because their talent pool maybe comes from central London and they want to come out. So it's just about giving variety, as you say.
I mean, we've obviously talked a lot about millennials. I hear a lot about the war on talent and how that is shifting. So is it a case of the actual product, whether it is on a business park or in the town centre, actually getting the product right that's going to help those businesses attract the younger workers, the graduates that are coming out?
I think there are two buildings in Reading at the moment, this building and the White Building, which we're involved with, and they've attracted the majority of the deals so far this year and are letting up the fastest because there's been this pent-up demand from people saying, do you know what, I don't necessarily want to necessarily be in a white glass box. Mm-hmm. I want something a little bit more inspiring and invigorating, and I want a Pret on the ground floor or a Costa or whatever. So I think we're just giving more choice. There isn't enough choice now at the moment. There's one or the other, but landlords are learning fast and providing different styles.
Well, I think, as James said, the reason I think it's pretty well balanced is because of how hard the business parks have worked. Our offices are in Green Park. I get on the bus when I get off the train in the morning to get to Green Park. The bus is generally full of millennials, multicultural gang of people on there. And so I think the answer for me to the question is providing the transport connectivity exists, and clearly there are some challenges, even in Green Park. That's why there's a significant amount of money, partly our money, going into the A33. We'll start building out Green Park Station Q1 2018. You know, you've got to work hard at that transport connectivity to make the business park attractive. And I guess if you look at, and I can only talk from experience of that one particular one, how hard the landlords have worked to make that community. So there are, you'll never get the amenity that you've got in the town centre, but there is an increasing sense that this is a good place to be because there's plenty going on and the things I need are there. But there is one other point, of course, millennials don't do what I do. They don't get on the bus at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning and get off the bus at. So actually that connectivity is so important that when they're diving into the office at 3 in the afternoon, are going to work there until midnight and then bail out, there is that ability to get in and get out whatever time of day because their lifestyles are different.
And I wanted just to ask, this is a question that's come in from the floor, it's not me just being cheeky, but it seems appropriate as we've talked about Thames Tower and obviously the White Building. But this is a question that's come in, and I'm obviously going to put this to James, is who else is taking space in the Thames Tower? Anyone signed a pre-let? Obviously, pre-let's a bit of a, because it's already completed. But
exactly right. So we did have a pre-let. So Austin Fraser took a pre-let from us and have taken the 11th floor. They moved in 10 days ago and have an insane fit out. It looked absolutely fabulous down there. Huge breakout areas, sunken auditoriums, huge sort of excitement around their fit out. And then actually quite intense areas of desking so that they can create little pockets of vibrant communities within their floor. We've also signed BDO, who've taken the 12th floor here, and HSBC have taken the 7th, and we have three other bits of space under offer within the building. Guy touched on the fact we signed up Pret down on the ground floor, and it's been in the news, so I can talk about it. CUP, KUPP, are under offer on the large restaurant suite, which means we'll be able to offer breakfast, lunch and dinner, and equally a place for you to grab a beer after work. So it's all part of that kind of amenity package within the building. And I think one of the things we're sort of touching on here is that space isn't necessarily just about the hardware anymore, about the bricks and mortar. It's more and more about the software. And whether that's the energy that our tenants bring in with their incredible fit-outs or the hard work that you're talking about that you have to put into these buildings now. So up here, between now and September, we have 16 events, whether that's tech events or events like this evening. We have our yoga classes starting next week. We have a chiropractor booked in. We have HIIT classes sorted out. There's a whole package of service behind here. And a lot of that is based upon this kind of collaboration within the building. Historically, buildings like this let in 2 or 3 chunks. Because the market has changed and a big letting now is probably 15,000 square feet, you know you're going to have a real community here. So it's about making sure all those people know each other and their businesses can thrive by being part of a little community.
If I may, and I appreciate you've got other questions, but if I just tie back this subject to the question on the vision, Reading 2050, I'm not particularly close to that, but I was close to Reading 2020. And I wonder sometimes if we ought to be a little bit more celebratory and focused on recognising what has been delivered against a vision. Now, Reading 2020, I think, was universally supported by the business community. And when we look back, and particularly sitting in this building, some of the projects that were in there that have been delivered, such as Reading Station, such as Chatham Place, Thames Tower now, and others, they really need celebrating, because what we've done is created this quite phenomenal high-density area around this station hub that enables people like the millennials and others more traditionally in business to operate as they wish. And I think we're certainly seeing that in Slough, and certainly Maidenhead has got some work to do now in that regard, and we want to put some money into that to support the arrival of the Queen Elizabeth line.
Okay, now I want to move on to one of the questions, which is sort of related because it's about occupiers. We've obviously talked about millennials and sort of a bit tech and science. But the question at the top of the screen, what is the Thames Valley doing to attract central government departments to decentralise to the region? HMRC to Croydon, FSA to Stratford, who's coming here? Anybody want to pick up on that, Guy?
If we need to attract, we've got things like Microsoft, Oracle, Hewlett Packard, and we've got Talis moved to Green Park, Pepsi moved to Green Park. All the big names are here. There's a much more sustainable economy and diverse economy that doesn't necessarily need a government.
And I get the premise behind the question, but most areas of Britain would want the data that we can argue, which is it's either 81 or 82% of the jobs just in Berkshire are private sector jobs, and that's what will drive the economy. So it might feel like a boon to the area to have those public brands here, but they're not actually going to drive the economy. And as Guy says, I think we have the credentials economically that others don't. And actually, I think the truth is I don't know. I mean, there was a drive to decentralise government departments probably now 10 years ago. And in those days, this area was seen as part of London, the sort of London city region. So it wouldn't be seen as much of a move going from, wherever they might be, to Reading, Slough, Maidenhead, or wherever else.
All right.
Okay, any questions from the floor as we pause before we move on? Keep your questions coming in on the screen. I am keeping an eye and do vote for the ones that you want me to ask. Okay, we're still on offices because there is a lot of questions about offices. I know, Guy, you mentioned the take-up was a bit down, only marginally down, you said. The question that came in pre-submitted was, with office take-up down last year, do you see this improving in the next year or so? I know you've mentioned a lot of requirements out there. What do you think take-up's going to be at the end of this year?
I think take-up could be down a little bit from as a result of Brexit. We were with an American occupier the other day, and he asked them, what's the effect of Brexit for you? And they said, well, look, we are going to sustain our location in the Thames Valley, but we're not necessarily going to be growing. If we're going to grow, we're going to go to Frankfurt, Paris, Amsterdam, wherever. So that might have an implication. What we're actually seeing is curious at the moment. We are seeing more deals being done than they were in previous quarters, in previous years, actually, cumulatively. But they're much smaller deals because people... are not taking large chunks of space. They're looking at their cost base, and that's going to have an impact on total take-up. But, we've traditionally measured take-up as being, the bigger the take-up, the better. But actually, more deals, more new businesses coming into the region is just as good, actually. Pricing is increasing. Supply is actually quite low on the five-year average. So I think we're in a pretty good place. I think it might drop slightly, but I think the main influence, and I've said this before, is going to be the people coming from central London, decentralising out to the region, and that will help pick up the take-up figures in the future.
Department for International Trade's figures for this area in terms of foreign direct investment showed that we had actually had a bumper year in 15-16, just in terms of publicly recorded investments. We're about fifth in the UK, and we're just behind the big city regions like Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds. And we were worried that, that figure would tail off in 16-17. We're just waiting for the figures to be checked, quality assessed, and all that sort of thing by central government. It looks like we're going to have a similar level of foreign direct investment, which I think is extremely welcomed. And again, the one of those measures is not about quantity, because actually the numbers are reasonably modest. The DIT measure them in terms of quality. So what is the business that is investing in the area? And again, we pretty much outstrip anywhere else in the country. About 60% of those projects that have invested, those businesses that have landed here from overseas, are high quality. Mm. And that indicates the sort of that we're attracting talent and highly paid jobs, which again contributes to the economy and supports the supply chain.
Mm. I'm going to come on to the question at the top of the screen in a moment, but just before we move on to that, I wanted to ask a bit about, we've talked about the volume of deals, but I wanted to ask about the type of occupiers that, this is a question that's come in about what type of occupiers are actually looking for space and what type of occupiers do you perceive being the occupiers that are going to move into the market. I don't know whether we can start with you, James, on the end, because obviously you've got a building that you're letting out.
Big part of our choice to invest across the Crossrail line, really, was this perception that a lot of the London businesses would put some of their other functions across the Thames Valley with this new connectivity through the Crossrail line. And actually, truth be told, to date, we haven't really seen any of it at any scale. Small bits, perhaps, but nothing more than that. Actually, in every market we're invested in Thames Valley, it's been the local guys moving around. So it's generally people moving for betterment, really. And as Guy said, in the old days, you had very little choice. You had a blue carpeted, suspended ceiling box that you were in, and you could move to another one if you wanted to. I think the change now is that many people have cottoned on to the fact that by giving someone an option which is physically better and the service is better, you actually do think your business can thrive in these locations. And truth be told, that's the game, isn't it? All of these businesses are looking to thrive, whether that's being able to get the best staff in, whether it's about being able to be part of a community.
So it's more local churn than new businesses. Guy, what are you seeing?
We're seeing just the experience that we've been having at the moment is that there have been most of the deals we've been doing are with American businesses, techcos, who have been moving out of a serviced office environment and wanting to have their own place, as it were, their own identity. And we've seen that, but we've also seen increasing letting velocity. So we're seeing them people doing deals quicker, which in an uncertain environment seems against the grain. You think people would delay, but that's not happening. And the sort of people we're talking to are recruitment businesses, which is a positive sign in itself. It means that the economy must be growing. We're seeing professional services companies who are actually shrinking. So accountants, solicitors and the like, business analysts, they're shrinking, they're looking at their cost base. And then it's the techcos. But you know, that we're looking at who is going to be the next entrant into the market. Is it going to be robotics? Is it going to be driverless cars? Tesla are based in Maidenhead. They have their HQ there. So I think we're looking for the next industries, and they will come across. But it's such a diverse environment, and that's to the benefit of the Thames Valley, that there are lots of different industries. We're not sort of hanging our hat on one particular sector.
Okay, I wanted to bring you back in. This is a question that's come from Slido. How does developing in the UK compare to developing in China, particularly when it comes to planning and other hurdles?
Painful. And it's painfully slowly as well. I think we've got to understand different country, different culture, and different system. But it's something, what I just said, it is painfully slow.
In
the UK. Give you a bit of history. ABB come to London and decided we're going to invest in London. It was decided 2010. It took us 2 years to complete the bidding for the land. It took us another 3 years to design and achieve planning. And then this took us another year to procure. I'll give you in perspective. I just mentioned our smallest project in Beijing is 20 million square foot. It complete from the point of we acquired the land to finish the last of the 500 building in 8 years time. So it gives you a bit of difference in terms of scale, but this is culture. We tend to get on with it and deal with the problem later. And UK, we also understand, is quite reversed. We try to work the detail and we don't have any problem later. So we learned that, and what we try to do is we try to bring the good from both sides to make it work so that we could have a risk-free development, but also done a bit of speed similar to what we tried to achieve back in China.
Tim.
I obviously can't comment on that, but I think it goes back to the one of the very earliest questions about this idea of devolution and a more joined up approach to authorities. And if we look at our local planning authorities, we have six small local planning authorities just in Berkshire. You then multiply that by what goes on in Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire and other parts of the Thames Valley, and there must be an argument, mustn't there, for saying that a different approach to that, particularly when we look at the tensions that go on between local planning authorities over housing numbers and objectively assessed needs and the duty to cooperate. So I think there is an argument there for scale and approaching things slightly differently. But I suppose my only comment on that would be, of course, it is not only culture, but it's scale. This is a completely different country. And, you know, it's a tiny island in many ways. But I'm not defending our planning system or I'm simply saying there must be a different way of doing it across boundaries, and the duty to cooperate is holding things up.
I think it's also how we see the government need to understand, especially for what we try to do is a major regeneration. There's a lot more, it's a mutual thing. Why a foreign investor or foreign development company want to come to UK, it's also want a mutual balance. We put in the investment, but in return, at least a bit of mutual support from the government. And in also some respect, for example, infrastructure and all those that kind of things, we kind of like can't be all paid by the developer. I mean, our main job is not building residential, make money. We are building a business district. What it is contributing the employment, contributing the GDP for the local, and we're contributing the tax revenue. So it is a mutual thing in order for, as a foreign investment company, especially developer in that scale, to work and also have a more direct dialogue with the planning and also with all level. That's how I see, and for my last few years experience, if we can improve on that, there will be even more foreign investor or foreign developer who come to the UK market.
But there has to be planning control, you know, John, because it's been ridiculous, this the permitted development. I'm not going to draw on all about this, but it does angst me that the planning authorities lost control of areas of town centres and business parks as well to residential, not being at through permitted development rights, and they're now sort of realizing and pulling back. But I think it's right, there's got to be some sort of cohesion, or else I think there's going to be a time bomb developing in the future whereby we're going to find that there are residential buildings which have been changed from offices which look absolutely ridiculous and sitting in the wrong environment. So there needs to be some sort of planning control.
I think that is one of the things is any developer who sitting around here understood there's a planning policy.
Yeah.
With that, we have to follow that planning policy. We know this building is destined for commercial, not apartments. So certain area, there's a planning policy, what it is. But what I'm talking about is about the detail.
Yeah.
Matching the planning policy for the location is one thing, but also just say how it look, how does it work?
Yeah.
What's the Section 106 contribution, all those kind of things can be shortened. And maybe it's just by negotiating with one party, not necessarily with others.
Yeah, you're clearly a responsible developer. There are plenty out there who maybe aren't.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure.
Two points that John made. I mean, we've argued the case to central government through the MPS for Heathrow expansion that actually there needs to be that one central authority to deal with the Heathrow expansion. We would argue that could be the Heathrow Strategic Planning Group. That's one point. The other point that, again, John introduced is who pays? Guy earlier touched on the Western Rail Link. This is our flagship project. It's something I chair, the Stakeholder Steering Group. I'm really concerned about this project because there's no public funding in Control Period 6 for Network Rail to fund this project. So who should pay? When there was an announcement probably 3-4 years ago by DfT for £500 million to fund the project, that was absolutely applauded. That money's no longer there, and the project's now probably about £1.2 billion. So there'll be some horse trading now. Who benefits from a Western Rail Link? We can all make the argument about who benefits now, but with the expansion of Heathrow, you can see the horse trading and the negotiations that will go on between London Heathrow, Department for Transport and others over where that bill will fall. And so often, no, maybe not so often, I think increasingly, I worry about the cost of infrastructure and the fact that if it isn't funded through the public purse, it won't be delivered. So maybe we need, and I know Network Rail is looking at this, looking at other options of how it might fund critical pieces of infrastructure, because the public purse cannot, whether we like it or not, whatever our ideology, it simply can't at the moment. So there need to be other models, whether that be Tier 4 or whatever it is.
Okay, we're actually out of time. I was hoping to do another question from the top of the screen, but we've run out of time and I've nearly got through everything that was on the list. So I hope you found that interesting, and if you'd like to join me in thanking our panellists, and thank you all for coming along. There's going to be drinks afterwards as well.